All right, how you guys doing? About to dive into some pretty heavy stuff, but hopefully this will be okay. 15 minutes on LGBT, it's not so bad. Kind of daunting, a little absurd. I'm just gonna, so you obviously can't cover everything that there is to cover with the LGBTQ topic in 15 minutes, so I'm just gonna offer a few thoughts tonight, but what I really wanna do is encourage everyone here to go and explore further with some of the many good resources that are out there. So I believe on the Southland's website, there's going to be kind of a resource list for each of these topics. And I curated a bunch of books that I recommend on the LGBT subject, homosexuality, transgender, etc. So I really would encourage all of us to go and do our homework, familiarize yourself with how Christians should respond to this issue, the biblical arguments, all of that. I can't touch on that here, but it's important that we as Christians in today's world know a good deal about this subject, because it's a subject that touches all of our lives. I would guess that most of us here tonight have at least some friend, a family member, a coworker who identifies as LGBTQ. So this is a something we can't avoid as Christians. It's in our culture, it's in our families, it's in our pews. Here this evening, there are probably people who deal with these issues. The LGBTQ subject is so important theologically, politically, because it gets to the heart of not only what marriage is, not only what sexuality and gender are, but what it means to be human. So the stakes are high with this topic, but it's not just a conceptual topic. It's a personal topic. It's a human topic. There are real people. There are real lives behind this. And so any conversation about this has to have a certain degree of tenderness and compassion. We have to approach this topic with great care. I've written about this topic quite a bit. I wrote about it in my book, Uncomfortable. Uncomfortable with a title like that, you have to really lean into the uncomfortable issues. So there's a section on sexuality, homosexuality. And I got a few notes, emails from people, and I'm just gonna read one that I got from a reader. A father who is a Christian father who is reading Uncomfortable with his small group, and his son is gay. And here's what he wrote to me. Dear Brett, I have a gay adult son who is now 26 years old and lives with his boyfriend. In your book, you mention, quote, "To love someone as Christ loves is to meet them in their sin, but to not let them stay there." My wife and I have until now decided to just love him and his boyfriend. They know that we don't agree with the lifestyle, but I fail to see how we would go about, quote, not letting him stay there. To me, it seems that that would just add contention and would be a very steep uphill battle. In addition, he was just a different kid from very early on, and I question, was he just born gay? I know that flies in the face of the Bible, but I'm telling you that I'm faced with this. I really do question my belief in this one aspect of the Bible. It's tough when I read stuff that you wrote in your book. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on this. So I wrote him back, and I won't get into our correspondence, but that's just an example of how there's no easy answers with this. This is a difficult personal thing that people are dealing with in their families, in their lives, so we have to handle this issue with tenderness and care. But we also need to balance our compassion with, I think, clarity and truth, because the Bible is actually very clear on its teaching about sexual ethics, as we've been going through in this sermon series, and homosexuality. But how do we do this? How do we balance love and compassion for the LGBTQ community while holding to the truth of God's word? So I want to focus on that question a little bit tonight in my brief time. And I'm not going to go into the biblical arguments about that, but there's lots of great resources that are going to be on the website. I encourage you to look at those. But just to summarize, and I think we're all kind of on the same page with this, if you were to summarize kind of the biblical witness on sexuality generally, it is this. Sex, the only proper place for sex, is in the confines of a covenantal relationship of marriage between one man and one woman. Any sex outside of that is, in the Bible's point of view, sin. It's problematic. So a good starting place for us as Christians is just to be consistent with looking at any sex outside of God's design as being problematic, not just singling out LGBT as like an especially egregious thing, but any sex outside of that that special place that God designed it to be for is problematic. I love the image that Ray Ortlund has. I preached about this in the Proverbs series last summer, but he compares sex to fire in the fireplace. Like, when fire is in the fireplace, its proper place, it's great, right? It warms the house, it's beautiful. But anytime you take fire outside of the fireplace, outside of its proper place, it burns, it's harmful. And the same is true with sex. Any type of sex that is outside of that proper place is going to be harmful. So we need to be consistent as Christians with pointing out heterosexual premarital sex just as problematic as homosexual sex. Pornography, like masturbation, all these forms of sex that take it out of its proper place, they're all problematic. Okay, so in my time remaining, I have 9 minutes left, I have three kind of points, suggestions for how we as Christians, as the church, can be better in our engagement with the LGBT community, those we are discipling who are struggling with this. Three suggestions for how to do this with both grace and truth, both compassion and clarity. All right, the first point I want to make is we need to challenge the notion of sexual identity. Our culture uses this phrase, sexual identity and sexual orientation. Like, it's so common in our culture that we just take it for granted. Like, yeah, sexual identity, what's your sexual orientation? But that these terms are actually very new in history, only in the last century or so. People 300 years ago would have no concept of homosexuality, heterosexual, that wasn't a word. Like, the idea that your sexuality was a part of your identity on this kind of ontological level, there was no concept of that. That's a new invention in history, and we take it for granted, but I think we need to push back on that a little bit, because the minute you identify with sex, like, it was actually a great tactic of the LGBT rights community to kind of elevate sex to the level of identity, because when your sexual preferences and desires suddenly become your identity, who you are, then anyone who challenges that, anyone who says that's sinful, it's like an assault on your very being. It turns into this cataclysmic fight. That's why there's so much pressure and political battles about this, because it's been raised to the level of identity. But it doesn't have to be that way. Like, in most of human history, sex is just one of many human things that you do. Like, it's something you do that creates children. It's one aspect of life, but it was never meant to be this, like, ontological, this is who I am, I was born this way, my sexual identity is X. So I think that's one thing we can do, is challenge that. Even challenging the language of calling yourself gay or bisexual, saying, I am this. Kira and I discipled a young man over the last couple years who wrestles with same-sex attraction. And one of the things I always admired about him in his process is that he never used the word gay. He refused to call himself gay. He would say, I wrestle with same-sex attraction. Like, that's a part of my life. But I'm not going to call myself gay because I don't want to identify as that. It's not who I am. It's not my identity. And I think that's a crucial thing that we need to encourage people that we're walking with who are dealing with this to not have that identity level of sex. Like, we all wrestle with sexual, you know, temptations, desires, but it doesn't have to be what we identify as. And of course, as Christians, we know that our most profound, wonderful, complex identity is in Christ, right? Like, our identity in Christ, union with Christ, is so much more glorious than any identity that's related to your sexual desires could ever be. So we need to push people to see how freeing identity in Christ can be as opposed to identifying with your sexual preferences. Okay, so that's one thing. In this confusing age of identity, sexual orientation, let's push back against that language. Okay, the second point I want to make is about change, this concept of change. What we need to do as we disciple people who are dealing with LGBT is to focus on the right kind of change. I think Christians in former eras maybe focused a little too much on behavioral change, right? Like, when someone would come out to them, they would be like, oh, you need to go to a therapist, you need to go to conversion therapy, let's pray the gay away, let's get them to be straight. That was the goal. The goal is not about, the most important goal is not a change in sexual orientation for any of us. It's a change of spiritual orientation. the main concern in discipleship has to be about spiritual orientation. That's the root issue that affects all of our desires, all of our behaviors, sexual or otherwise. The goal in discipleship is not heterosexuality, it's holiness. And what's great about this approach is that it involves all of us. All of us are in that journey together. No matter if the sexual thing we're dealing with is LGBT or porn addiction or whatever, we're all on this journey towards holiness. That's the most important goal. Sam Alberry, who's a same-sex attracted Christian who is committed to celibacy, he says this. He says, Jesus said that if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And the key word is anyone. To follow Jesus, all of us will have to say a deep and profound no to some of our deepest intuitions and longings. Jesus doesn't put self in front of identity. He puts it in front of denial. So to the LGBT person, the goal has to be spiritual change above all. But I will say that what happens often with spiritual change, with our heart change, is sometimes it leads to the desires of our heart changing. Our behavior can change. And I get sad when I hear Christians especially kind of write off change. They say, it's never going to happen. My desires are never going to change. It's hopeless. We are the people of the resurrection. We believe the spirit that rose Jesus from the dead is within us. Like, if we don't believe change is possible, who is? So we have to at least be open. We have to have faith that change is possible. And it doesn't happen for everyone. And there's plenty of same-sex attracted people who live their whole lives and it never changes. They never move beyond it. But there's also plenty of stories of people who have dealt with same-sex attraction who have seen growth, who have seen change. They've seen their desires change. People like Rosaria Butterfield, Jackie Hill Perry, both of them have great books you can read. They're now married to men, came out of homosexual lifestyles. So change is possible. The most important change is spiritual orientation, becoming holy. But as people of the resurrection, we cannot be closed off to the power of the Spirit in us to reshape and reorder our broken desires. Okay, and I have 2 minutes left. So my third point that I wanted to make is this. We as the church need to be better about celebrating singleness and celibacy as a calling. Because if we tell someone who comes to us who has same-sex attraction, like, sorry, like the only real option for you is lifelong celibacy if you want to be a faithful Christian. And that may be the case for them. If they don't feel any desire for the opposite sex, if marriage is never going to be an option for them, then we do have to say, sorry, singleness, celibacy is your only option. If we say that to them, we then have to be a community that makes that an attractive option. Like, sadly, too many churches are so focused on marriage and kind of elevating marriage and the family that singles just don't feel at home there. They don't feel part of the family. And you're not going to be a welcoming community for same-sex attracted single people unless you make them feel like they can really be part of the family, to find that relational intimacy. Part of it is we need to redeem relational intimacy in a culture that is so sex-saturated, where every relationship, every friendship has this weird kind of tinge of sexuality to it. We need to model how there can be relational intimacy outside of sex. In our male-to-male friendships, female friendships, like, we can have deep relational friendship and intimacy without sex. And so if we can be a community, a family, where the same-sex attracted single celibate person feels like they have deep bonds, they're brothers and sisters with us, they're uncles and aunties in our church, that is a hopeful place for them. Otherwise, it's just a very lonely road relationally. We are made for relationship as humans. So just imagine being in the shoes of someone for whom marriage, that deep, most profound, intimate relationship is not an option. We need to compensate for that by being a community that elevates the calling of singleness and celibacy. After all, Jesus was that, right? Jesus was single and celibate. Paul was single and celibate. So it's not as if there aren't biblical heroes who were that way. We need to be churches that embrace and elevate that calling. So I'm pretty much done, but I'd love to answer any follow-up questions in the Q&A about anything I talked about. Thanks.
Everybody. everybody. Hello, hello. So I'm Summer Teal. I've had a chance to meet quite a number of you just in attending here at 9 a.m. services, but I'm also an educator at Braille-Linda High School. So I've been in the public school system for 20 years as a teacher, and I will tell you that when the state of California released their new sex ed framework, I was a little terrified. I was a little very glad I was teaching English. Very grateful that I didn't have a credential to teach health, and confident that I wasn't going to be asked to teach health. And part of that concern that was raised in me was because I remember having the birds and the bees conversation for the very first time with my oldest child, and looking at her tenderly as the fruit of my womb, gazing upon her as I very poetically and beautifully explained the wonderful act that her father and I had engaged in together to produce her. How our souls were rejoined as they were meant to be in a state of communion that really God blesses. And looking upon my eighth grader and thinking she might throw up right now in the midst of all this beauty. So I remember that moment, and then it gave me such a revelation of the incredible job that our public ed teachers have to do in their health classes. And if you've been a parent or a mentor to some kid that you had to explain the birds and the bees to, that is a daunting task, and it's not easy, even if you've been with them since they were right out of the womb. It's really terrifying. But that has become the job of public ed teachers, is to try to walk children that they don't know, that come from a variety of homes with a variety of background knowledge about the subject, to try to walk them through to a place of physical safety. And it's such a beautiful discrepancy that you pointed out, Brett. Ultimately, what we want for our kids is spiritual health. That's what we're after in our community. The public education system doesn't have space for that. They're not allowed to deal with that. So what they're after is trying to get kids to a physically healthy place when it comes to sex ed. And when I was asked to speak on this, my first issue was I just have to get educated on what the new framework is so that I could really talk in a more informed way about what our public schools are doing in regards to sex ed. So I want to share a little bit about that with you today, and then just also talk about how we can respond to that. And I think, Eric, when you were opening up, we're supposed to know what we're talking about. You know, we can't buy into rumors. We can't be looking at stuff on YouTube videos. We can't be reading articles by random publications and saying this is the truth about what our kids are being taught. We have to be informed. So I'm hoping that I can share a little bit of what I've learned with you today, and then also just my experience in the classroom interacting with the kids, and hopefully that'll help just a wee little bit. Public schools are for the public. They're not for us, right? Our kids, if we want to mentor them and guide them, and we want them to go off to school in the morning or stay at home for school in the morning, we can invest in that and trust in theirs getting some sort of spiritual empowerment during the course of the school day. But public ed is not geared towards that. Public ed is geared to react to what's happening culturally. React to what's happening culturally. We know what's happening culturally. And so public ed is trying to essentially do damage control. They're not trying to control the church. They're trying to control damage that's happening from a damaged society. And it's a very big task. Can you cue the next slide for me? This is kind of, I put this together just so we can kind of have a visual of what our cultural context looks like when we're talking about sex ed. One of the first things that's taught in the sex ed classes, in their health classes, is just how to have healthy relationships. A lot of what Brett was saying, that they don't have to be sexually driven. You can have relationships that are just nurturing and compelling. And even some relationships that kids are engaged in that don't involve sex can be harmful and destructive too. Right? You can have over needy friends or friends that kind of suck your energy clean out of you. So one of the things they talk about, and part of the new framework, is dealing with just healthy relationships, how to be a good listener, how to be a good talker. and how to make sure that your relationships are healthy and not draining. Our school obviously is concerned about LGBTQ, and we have a variety of students that identify as being either gay or bisexual or transgender. And it's not the concern of the school necessarily to work on the spiritual healing that Brett was talking about. The concern of the school is, are all of those kids safe on campus from being harassed or even hurt on campus? So the framework also deals with the LGBTQ society and protecting them, knowing that because the public school is kind of a microcosm of our culture, we have a population of those kids that need to be protected and safeguarded just like our children do. We have a rise of STDs in California. We don't have the highest in the state, but it's on the rise. So whether or not we would want to have conversations about safer sex in the classroom, there is a need that the state has recognized, which is why it's been built into the framework. Kids aren't all abstaining from sex. A lot of them are. A lot of them are. We actually have really good numbers in the nation for kids that are saying no to sex before marriage. But because STDs are on the rise, that's part of the framework as well. Educating kids about STDs that are out there and talking to them about how to have safer sex, always, and the framework specifies this too, always defaulting to abstinence as the only safe method to completely avoid it. So your health ed teachers aren't, you know, pulling out condoms and demonstrating them on a mannequin and doing weird stuff like that. That's not happening. But they are having conversations where it used to be the framework said you could only talk about abstinence. That's no longer the case because, in a nutshell, it didn't work from a health standpoint for the kids. They needed something else. And so now, in addition to advocating for abstinence, they're also talking about safer sex practices because they are interested in the health of the kids. Also up there, we have a little image up there that shows teenage pregnancy. I get pregnant students in my classroom every year. And those are the ones that tell me. So that's still an issue in our state. And so the health classrooms talk about contraception. Again, pressing abstinence. And that's in the framework that has to be mandated. They must advocate for abstinence above all other else as the only way to avoid unplanned pregnancies. And then lastly, obviously, we have transgender students. I have two that I'm teaching currently that I know of. I'm not always told because they have their privacy rights, but they are part of our population, and we know that. And so kids have to be taught, these children have chosen this, this is what they have decided on, they're now in the school system, and there's no place for harassing or bullying them. And in a way, if you think of this, that makes good sense. You know, I think as Christians, we have had reputations for being arrogant hypocrites, when really we should be extravagant lovers. And teaching kids to love on one another, treat each other kindly, be safe around each other, I think that's a reputation that we can really kind of latch on to. The next slide for me, please. These are the state framework requirements. So these are the things that have to be taught, and they're extremely vague. So I know there was a lot of rumors floating around about what's in the framework and what's being taught in different school districts. Please don't buy into those. Please don't, like, latch onto something and think that that's truth. Don't believe everything you read. If you want to read the frameworks, it'll kind of talk about these things. Where what we're teaching is... This idea of sexual preference, the way it's being taught is not this sexual preference is right or wrong, or this is preferable, or this is a choice for you to consider. It's not being taught that way. It's being taught the same way that the state had to switch over and start teaching like divorced families, where it was like, this was a reality of the culture, and therefore we need to allow kids to see how that could play out. They want to show students that sometimes you're going to have, in one family, two same-sex parents. In the same way that they created literature to show sometimes you're going to have just one parent from a divorced family. They're working on, again, from that second bullet, just talking about the reduction of HIV, the reduced risk of HIV, talking about the use of contraception, and then also, again, tolerating the LGBTQ community. And I think what's important is that nothing is being promoted within the school, but info is being shared. So while kids are getting this information, also worked into the language of the framework is that a teacher or a class cannot demonstrate any biases. So a teacher can't say, this would be a good choice for you, or you should consider this, or your feelings tend to lean you this way, this seems like this would be a good fit for you. Instead, it's just to inform, and then to encourage tolerance. Okay, next slide, please. Oh my gosh, this time goes fast. I'm just going to kind of run through some of the facts that I learned as I was researching the framework. I heard terrible rumors that like things were being taught to like elementary school kids in the BOUSD school system. That's not true. So sex ed and these kind of health classes aren't taught until seventh grade and up. Parents are required by the framework to receive notification. That means you must receive documentation from the school district identifying when information is going to be taught when. And this kind of goes back to what Eric was saying about being informed. You're going to be told, and you should know. There's training for instructors. Not just anybody can walk in and teach a health class and just kind of wing it and go rogue, where all of a sudden they're talking about random things and filling your kid's head full of information. Most school districts request parental involvement. As a matter of fact, if you go online right now, to the BOUSD website, you can actually sign up to be part of like a think tank for the Brayolinda Unified School District. You can participate in that. They want parent volunteers. And the idea is that they don't want, and I can speak for the school district on this, because my close friends are the ones that are teaching the health classes. They don't want to, and by the way, both of them are Christians, if it makes you feel any better. They're not looking to press an agenda. They're not looking to pollute your child's mind. What they're looking to do is share information about how to keep kids physically safe. And as we see kids kind of reacting to the culture, how to kind of stem the tide of the physical manifestations of that problem. So you getting involved, understanding that teachers are trained specifically for this, and then also, last but not least, you can have your child opt out of any or part of the instruction. So if you look at everything, you get educated on the subject, you have your input, and you're still like, you know what, this isn't right for my kid. And I do have a child where I feel like if they had to sit through that class, they wouldn't make it and hold down their lunch. So if that's not for your kid, you have the option of pulling them out. Because at the end of the day, while we as Christians are servants to all, we're doormats to none. If I don't like what you're teaching my kid, you're not going to get it. You're not going to tell her. And we have that authority within us. So while we can be a little intimidated by the change, and we should because it reflects the culture, that doesn't mean that we have lost our rights as parents to pull our kids out. Can you go to the next slide, please? Just some ways that you can work with your own kids. I feel like talking early to them is critical. And by early, I mean like literally when they're tiny, just talking to them about who they are in Christ, right? And I love what you were saying. Like they don't have to identify their feelings with their identity. My child, I'm hungry. You're not hungry. You may feel hunger, but you don't have to answer to that feeling. You may feel angry, but you are not anger personified. You don't have to answer to that. Our children are going to feel sexual pulls. That doesn't mean we have to answer to that. I surround your family, if I could give you any advice, surround your family with the Word of God. Read it. Listen to podcasts in the car. Have them play apps on their devices that deal with Scripture. And then last but not least, be that guiding light. And I think this is something that we can do with our children and the rest of our community. You know, and the biggest pushback I've had from this is that people say, well, I can't tell my child not to commit this sin because I did it. So I did it myself. I had premarital sex, or I had same-sex attraction, or I engaged in this activity, and therefore I can't. Your experience with sin doesn't make you a hypocrite, it makes you an expert. Y'all know exactly what you're talking about now. So when we look at our kids and we caution them, you know, we're not coming from a place of, well, I'm perfect. We're coming from a place of, I was broken. Don't. Right? Don't. And to continue that throughout our community, right? We have so much to give, right? We do. To our kids, to our neighbors, to our community here. And we can do that. Thanks.
Hi, guys. We're going to talk about porn. I think this talk was originally titled Sex and Technology. That's just a covert way of saying pornography. So I'm going to give you the porn talk. The reason I'm so passionate about this issue and the reason why I work with it, specifically with a lot of the clients that I work with couples and individuals, is because I see how much brokenness is out there. And I know every single one of you have been affected by pornography, whether it's you, whether it's somebody that you know, whether it's your kids. So I think it's something that's important for us to talk about specifically as the church. So I'm going to start with some statistics. Regarding prevalence, the top three porn sites have more regular users than Twitter, Wikipedia, Netflix, and Instagram. 35% of all downloads on the internet are pornographic material. 64% of self-identified Christian men and 15% of self-identified Christian women watch porn at least once per month. As far as the societal impact, 93% of boys and 62% of girls were exposed to pornography before the age of 18. And the average age of exposure is now 11 years old. One study found that 88% of porn videos showed physical aggression and that women responded neutrally or positively to this, since it was primarily men against women. This connects to another study that shows that boys aged 10 to 15 that had exposure to violent pornography, it predicted a six-fold increase in the chances of them acting out sexually violently in the future. 25 to 30% of all porn viewers are now women. And the third most searched category of porn is teen. And there are now hundreds and hundreds of millions of images and videos of child pornography on the internet. That is a very different picture than what our culture tells us about pornography. So the image that we get from pornography in movies and in TV shows is often lighthearted. It's people giving each other a hard time. Now there's a lot of jokes about women watching it, you know. And these statistics are so sobering because it goes so far against that narrative that we've received. A woman named Marianne Layden, who stood before the Senate in 2004, said that if pornography made us healthy, we would be healthy by now. And the reality is that we're not. So to go into more, it's going to also touch on sexual addiction. Classic sexual addiction before the internet existed, when people had to go to stores to receive pornography, either videos or magazines, there was a huge correlation with early sexual trauma or insecure attachment that then led them to go look at pornography. Now what we're seeing, because there's affordability, accessibility, and anonymity, those three A's, it's now in people's pockets, and there's no longer this correlation necessarily to any kind of insecure attachment or trauma. The irony of this is that they found that pornography viewing actually causes an increase in depression, anxiety, and insecure attachment. So before, the insecure attachment caused somebody to then seek out pornography and act out, and now pornography viewing is actually causing insecure attachment in relationships. So you'll hear a lot of people compare pornography addiction with substance addiction, and it's because it's really, really similar. So our brains are hardwired to have this reward system where we remember the things that we like and we keep doing it to survive. So we don't like hunger. Our brains like the feeling of feeling full and delicious food. Therefore, we keep eating to survive. God made sex pleasurable, so therefore we keep reproducing and have lots of sex. The hard part is when our brains get hijacked in this way, and this reward system is hijacked, which then means that pornography specifically is this really, really concentrated version of sex devoid of any kind of emotional intimacy, which spikes our dopamine levels really, really high in our brain and makes us want it more and more and more. The tricky part is then our brains are completely tied to sexual experience being tied to images on a screen rather than in person. So they're actually seeing increased levels of erectile dysfunction in younger and younger men. What's also interesting is that with substance use, there's a need to have more and more and more of the substance in order to get to the same high. So you'll hear people talking about chasing that original high. And with pornography, the difference is that you need variety. So the brain's looking for novelty. And that's how you have people that are getting involved in different kinds of videos that they never thought they would get involved in. With all these statistics that are pretty shocking just about younger and younger kids regarding pornography, it's no shock because in order to have that same level of high, people are doing more and more and more to get that same high. This also means that there's this compartmentalization that happens. And so what ends up occurring is in order to engage in behavior that you yourself morally don't agree with, there has to be this compartmentalization that happens psychologically. And so then what that means is in order for us to live with ourselves and have this behavior that we're engaging in that we don't necessarily agree with, there's kind of this split that happens. And what they notice is that during pornography viewing, there's actually an impairment in executive functioning in the front part of the brain. So all that matters is getting that high and that reward system met. So in order to feel high and to cope with our problems, that is then what's used to cope with our problems is something like pornography in a very similar way that somebody would use something like alcohol. This also then affects our relationship with other people, because if we're engaging in this behavior and there's lots of shame with this split happening where we're engaging in behavior that we don't agree with and we can't stop no matter how hard we try, then shame comes into the picture, which then usually causes some withdrawal and some defensiveness. So that affects marriages because now there's this withdrawal within a marriage relationship or a dating relationship. It can bring up feelings of betrayal in the partner and, depending on the situation, even some symptoms of trauma. So this idea of, I have this secure attachment to this person. I've now found out that they are going somewhere else for sexual satisfaction and what I perceive to be connection, and now I can no longer trust this person. So this prevents intimacy, it promotes worthlessness, not just in the person that is hurt by their partner doing this, but feelings of worthlessness in the person that's acting out. Because often, and this is the case with a lot of clients I work with, they don't want to engage in this behavior. If they thought it was okay, they wouldn't be coming to see me, right? So by them coming to see me, there's this disconnect of, I keep doing the very thing that I hate and I don't want to do it, like Paul talks about. This also affects the greater community because if the majority of pornography is objectifying women and pornography is self-serving, then that means that there are some men that might have a tendency to withdraw from community a little bit because there's this hesitancy to interact with females. Because if I'm only seeing pornography that's objectifying women, okay, well, I don't really want to necessarily like interact with females in that way, especially if they're single. And you're missing out on this entire community, half of the people that are made in the image of God, and it's also causing you to kind of withdraw from community. And then lastly, this affects our relationship with God. So if God created us to live in complete wholeness, and like Alan talked about on Sunday, to live without shame, the tricky part is that when sin entered the world, then shame happened, and then the way that shame presented itself is that they hid their bodies, right? They hid from God and they covered their bodies. And I don't remember anywhere where Adam or Eve in that moment looked at each other and said, no, you are made in the image of God. You are beautiful. Do not cover yourself. There is nothing to be ashamed of. They were not only ashamed of themselves, but now they're putting shame on the other person and saying, you should be ashamed too. Here, let me help you cover yourself up. Let me help you cover your nakedness. So then what ends up happening is then they both withdraw from God. So then we have this tendency to kind of hide from God because we don't want to have to face what we've done. So So I understand that this is really heavy, and this is a lot, especially because, like I said, our culture kind of views it as this like light, kind of laughable thing. And so I think the real goal with this is to move toward wholeness and healing without shame. And that's really difficult to do because shame creeps up very quickly, especially with this particular issue. So I really love what Mark Laser says in his book, Healing the Wounds of Sexual Addiction. It's on the resource list. And he goes through these different steps and these solutions that we can look at that can give us hope. So the first of those is grieving. So you have to be able to grieve the behavior that you've done and the consequences that it's caused for you and to other people. So being able to grieve that disconnect between I don't want to engage in this behavior and I can't stop coming back to it, there needs to be that acceptance and that grief that that's occurred. Next, to be able to confess to somebody and to repent, so to turn from that. Next, expressing feelings and needs. Oftentimes, pornography is used as a way to be able to kind of boost that reward system when there's negative feelings. So I feel a negative feeling, I don't like feeling that negative feeling, therefore I'm going to go to pornography because that's going to make me feel better. So a lot of the people that I work with, once they remove pornography from the equation, and now they have to face their feelings and not go to pornography to then cope, it's very, very difficult. So it takes a lot of bravery, but being able to express those feelings and needs and knowing that they'll be met outside of a pornographic context, met within the community. Which then leads to the next point that he makes, that there is strength in groups. So notice by me saying groups, I didn't say one accountability partner, because a lot of people put a lot of faith in that one accountability partner or that one system that blocks media, and there are ways to get around that. Believe me, I see people all the time like, well, I just use data, or well, I didn't tell that person. I'll often too see couples where the spouse is the accountability partner. I also highly recommend against that, because then what ends up happening is the one person that acts out doesn't want to tell their spouse because they know it'll hurt them. Then if they do tell that spouse, the spouse is like, well, I can't give my honest reaction of how hurt I am because then that'll shame them and they won't want to tell me in the future. And it gets really convoluted really quickly. So they're being strengthened groups. There was one survey that surveyed men in particular that had completely recovered from this. And they asked them, what was the most helpful part in your journey to find sexual freedom and freedom from pornography? And 80% of them said their recovery group. So there's groups like Celebrate Recovery, which is a Christian-based recovery group. There's also ones that are specifically for sexual addiction and pornography addiction. But that's a major, major part of healing within the community. So taking it one day at a time, eliminating temptation, negative thoughts, and shame that comes up, preparing for attacks from the enemy and from yourself that are going to be coming up, and then building something new. So the reason that this is so tricky to treat, that same woman that I mentioned earlier, Marianne Layden, she had treated those with substance abuse history and those with sexual addiction. And she said that the sexual addiction, the pornography addiction, was sometimes so much more difficult to treat because not only are you tearing down this negative framework for sex, you have to then rebuild a healthy framework for sex. So like you don't need heroin to survive. You will likely be engaging in sex and sexual intimacy still. So you have to rebuild this healthy concept of sex and intimacy. And then just what I would hope for this community, that we'd be able to create an environment where we can all share, you know, where sex education, that really starts in the home, right? When I was 10, I came across my first pornographic image, and thankfully I've never struggled with pornography. But I think it's very telling that the first thing I did was I ran home and I told my mom, Mom, I was at so-and-so's house. I clicked on something. This came up, and my brave mom typed in that URL and looked and wanted to see what I saw. But there was something about the fact that I knew I could go to her, and I wasn't going to experience shame. I wasn't going to get into trouble. I knew that she would love me, right? And so there was this comfortability of, you can't protect your kids from all of this. There's a 1 in 14 chance that kids are going to mistype a URL and end up on a porn site. I mean, it's highly likely with 93% of girls and 62%, or sorry, 93% of boys and 62% of girls coming across this, we are all most likely going to come across this. But if we create a culture where kids can talk to us about what they've seen that makes them feel uncomfortable, where our peers can come to us and can admit, this is what I've been struggling with, where the church can do that. I always think it's beautiful that clients can tell me, I've never told anybody this before, but da da da. But there's something that would be even more beautiful about, well, I have this beautiful community, and I've already been able to share that in community, and I'm wanting further help. And I really, really feel like it starts in the church and being able to create that environment. This is too big of an issue for us to handle on our own. It's huge. It kind of preys on what it means to be human and to have desires. But God's bigger than that. And through God, that's the only way we're going to be able to overcome it in our community. So.
Okay, so I'll invite up our panelists and find a place, any place, as well as I'm welcoming up Alan Frau, who's lead pastor of Southlands. We had a sense, and that is proving true, that there might be some questions relating to church and our culture and how we approach these things. And so Alan is going to help out with that as well. So yeah, let's just give it up one more time for these guys. You've just done some great work. And I want to just plug that resource list that Brett mentioned. They've all put things on there relevant to their talk as well as sort of looking further. So no surprise, Brett has a long list of books. Summer has actually included the curriculum and slides from the BOUSD. So again, just pursuing information and clarity around those things. Then Lee has got a whole treasure trove of stuff, including some links to recovery groups and other resources that you can go to kind of, you know, on your own time, in your own way to pursue those things. So with that said, we have gotten a few questions already, and please feel free. We don't have tons and tons of questions. I think any one of these could launch quite the discussion. But please do go ahead and feel free to text the number on the screen. So I'm going to start with this first one, and I think it's a great one. This will be for Brett. But I also want to make sure that, you know, anybody feels a freedom to chime in on this. We're a bit informal here. So if someone is same-sex attracted but does not act on their desires, is that still a sin?
There's differences of opinion in the theological world. This is kind of an active conversation right now. I mean, I would say temptation not acted upon isn't sin, because Jesus himself, right, Hebrews said he was tempted in every way, but was without sin. So that would indicate that one can face temptation and not sin if they abstain from it, which Jesus, as we know, never sinned, and yet he faced temptation. So that would be my answer to that. Just having the temptation is not sin. But I would say, like, if you in any way put yourself in circumstances or repetitive behavior that kind of puts that temptation in front of you, then that is maybe where you're culpable a little bit. Mm-hmm. So,
good. Anybody else on that? I actually maybe a follow-up sort of companion question. In the last few centuries, the church has done a lot of harm in terms of ostracizing and marginalizing those who experience LGBTQ desires. What can the church do to right this wrong so as to create space for dialogue that otherwise seems lost because of the hurt? It would seem that in some sense, hopefully, this is accomplishing some of that. But does anybody else want to take a shot at that or respond to that?
Is it on? I think the damage has been, firstly, just condemnation and grading of homosexual sin as worse than other sin. And, you know, the Bible is really clear about homosexual sin being a part of sexual immorality, but it's just a part of a laundry list. And in fact, you know, the 1 Corinthians 6 passage that the real aggro Christians always use, you know, these people will not inherit the kingdom of God. Right along next to homosexuality is idolatry, which just includes all of us. You know, that means none of us inherit the kingdom of God, because all of us have been idolaters in some way. So I think condemnation and grading of sin. But then I think as we've got more woken up to the fact that it's not a worse sin than others, and so now there's this rising sense of, okay, well, how do we see redemption? I think the damage has been that we've tried to place a formula on what redemption looks like for someone who's same-sex attracted. And as Brett so wonderfully said, we've tried to change behavior in terms of change their sexual orientation, and hopefully it's heterosexual, not realizing that actually many people will, even after they've repented of that, not lose those desires altogether. And we've just got to have a broad enough framework to be able to journey with people, some of whom have those desires taken completely and others don't. And in our church, we walk with both. I've married people in the life of this church who have arrived as homosexuals and are now married with children, and that's just a wonderful thing. But walk with others who really feel like they will never get married because they feel like God has not taken those things away. And so I think we haven't always understood the great cost of what it is to follow Jesus as someone who's same-sex attracted, and the responsibility to be family to those who are single.
Good. I've got some more on that, but I'm going to actually skip to some questions for Summer and then maybe return to those. So quick question, are you aware whether or not the state gives abortion as an option as part of the sex education curriculum?
To my knowledge, it's not listed in the framework. And that doesn't mean that it's not necessarily mentioned within some school districts, but it's not a taboo subject on campus. The kids want to talk about it because they know it's a cultural issue, and they're processing through their own feelings on topics like that. Mm-hmm. So while it is a subject that it sometimes arrives within the classroom as a controversial subject, and kids are thinking through their own morality on that topic, that can happen in any classroom. It can happen in an English classroom during controversial speeches or whatever, but to my knowledge, it's not being taught as part of the health framework.
Okay, here's another one, a little more personal. As a high school health teacher, I have to teach the framework you discussed. Thank you for explaining it, by the way. How can I support my LGBTQ students in this unit without condoning their actions?
Yeah, I think, you know, you have plenty, I don't know who that is, you, you out there, you have plenty of kids that aren't Christian. And you love them. And I think that's the calling of those of us who are teaching in the public ed system. We know that our demographic, even there's kids in there that might profess Christianity, they're only nominal Christians. They don't actually maybe even have a relationship with Jesus. They identify as being Christian because they're white in Southern California. But they don't necessarily have a grid for what that is. Right? Yeah. So, and I don't have like this raging percentage of Christians in my classroom and then one kid that's, you know, not that identifies as transgender or something. Most of my kids don't know Jesus, or they're in the process of developing a relationship with them, and love them. But if they ask you how you feel on the subject, and if you get close to some of these kids who are processing through it, they will ask you. Tell them not your opinion. Give them the Bible's perspective on it. Mm. You know, ultimately, you know, we're not spokespeople. As Christians, we're not spokespeople for our own values. We're spokespeople for the Lord. So it's not your opinion on the subject. You're to be the salt and the light. You're supposed to know your stuff and then speak it in truth and grace and just love them. Mm-hmm. You know, Jesus' greatest weapon of war was love. And I will tell you from 20 years of experience, it doesn't matter who walks in my classroom, if I love them, they will not be able to resist me. They can't. They can't.
You cannot resist me.
Because it's the Jesus model.
Yeah.
We love him because he first loved us, extravagantly, unapologetically, unashamedly. He takes pride to be seen with us. If you feel that way about your kids, you'll be able to make an impact and speak it in truth.
So if I'm hearing you, Summer, and I think reading sort of one layer deeper on this question, I think the wrestle sounds like, I've got to make it clear to the student how I feel about this lifestyle, even though I also want to be supportive, but I also want the other piece. How compelled do you feel, and in your own conscience, do you feel to make students aware of that, or is it really on a as they ask you kind of basis?
Yeah, it's a case-by-case kind of thing, and then, I don't speak about it, and I don't bring up the subject and then say, hey, by the way, I'm heterosexual and enjoy sleeping with my husband. I prefer not to talk about sexuality with my students. But if I get close to one of them and they ask me my personal opinion on it, I have a Bible on my desk, I'll be like, this is what I follow. This is the model I follow. From what I understand, this is what it says about it. And so because I've professed it, that's how I'm gonna go.
Good.
And then it's not personal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if it was, up to some of us, maybe, that everybody would get into heaven regardless of behavior and we would all be happy and in love with Jesus. But it isn't up to us. And our job is to profess the truth of that, I think, when asked. Mm. So
good. That's great. Thank you. I'm going to go to Leah. And we've actually got a nice even distribution of these. Maybe that's just Ryan is helping me out. So this one is kind of, give us some tips for a friend whose husband deals with sexual addiction and pornography. How can I advise her in the wife's role in that healing?
Well, first, it can be such an isolating thing. I don't know if you guys watch the podcast, it's a little bit of my story more on there, but I got into this because I was dating somebody who really, really struggled with this. And it can be so isolating because there can feel like this need to protect that person's reputation. And there can be this loneliness that's in that. And so even just you supporting that friend and loving them and listening to them, because they clearly feel safe enough to share that with you when they might not feel safe enough to share that with other people or even the church. So that's a major way you can support them. And then there's actually listed, there's support groups for partners of those who are struggling with sexual addiction. Mm-hmm. So COSA is a major one. And getting them involved in community, because even though they can't control their spouse's actions, they can still find healing in the midst of trying to walk their spouse through this and trying to navigate that, because it's something that not a lot of people are talking about.
That's good. Yeah. Again, on the homepage, God and Sex Resources is where you'll find those things. I'm going to stay with you, and this is a great question. At what point is pornography use considered an addiction? And at what point should someone pursue help?
So I typically use it's the American Society for Addiction Medicine. They have their definition of addiction, and that's typically what I and a lot of other clinicians will use to define what an addiction is. So that's an inability to abstain from the behavior, so that lack of behavioral control. It's a craving, so there's like this increased appetite for it. If you have like a diminished sense for how it's affecting you and your life, like how it's affecting your personal life and your relationships. And then lastly, if there's kind of this dysregulated emotional response. So there's that compartmentalization or like splitting that I was talking about, where you kind of have these two sides of you, where it's not like you're being like open and honest and working through it, and it's not really a struggle, and you don't feel this need of like, I can't stay away from this, and I've tried to stop and I can't. That's usually the key. And the reason I hesitate to put any kind of like, if you watch it this often, you are an addict, is because some people watch it, compared to other people, like not that frequently, but they still feel like they can't resist the mm-hmm. need to watch it. Mm-hmm. And so that could feel like compulsive sexual behavior. And other people are going to really, really struggle with it. So it's definitely a spectrum. And I would say if there is that sense of I'm enslaved to this in a way where mm-hmm. I can't stop even if I wanted to, that's when you're going to want to seek help.
Yeah, I mean, it seems well put. I would imagine that like any sin that you return to and can't seem to be able to resist, this is danger, Will Robinson. There's a red flag that's an old reference. I'm 47 years old.
I get it.
I'm going to go back to LGBTQ. Some great questions here. This is along the lines of, Brett, what you were talking about in terms of identity. And then I've got one for kind of you and Al as both elders of the church. How is being gay, lesbian, not a part of someone's identity? It may not be all that they are, but it definitely seems like it could be as big a part of who they are as ethnicity or other genetic trait. Does it just depend on whether or not we agree that people are born this way?
Don't turn it off, Alan. Keep it on.
You get when you share a mic with Frau.
yeah, I mean, this is a huge question right now. I think identity and just identity politics and just everything that goes around with identity in today's culture, we just have to remember this is a fairly new phenomenon in human history, just talking about identity in all these categories, ethnicity, sex, gender, whatever, like most of human history just didn't even think in those terms. So it's a new thing. Anyone who's interested in what I was saying about the term heterosexual, homosexual being new things that didn't exist, you know, prior to the 19th century, there's a great article called Against Heterosexuality it's online, you can Google it, and First Things, I think, is where it was published. But it gives a great history of that terminology and just the idea, the concept of sexual identity, which is how it kind of came along, and Freud and other people like that kind of popularized mm-hmm. sex as this identity thing. It's an aspect, like any desire we have is an aspect of who we are, but it's sad when we reduce who we are to our desires, because we have a lot of desires, unwanted desires, and society tells us, you know, to make our identity upon those desires. That seems like that's kind of a depressing place to be. Tim Keller has this great image, metaphor that he uses, and I'm not going to get it exactly right, but he talks about how in any given period of history, in any context, there's this kind of grid upon which certain of our desires are in favor and are kind of encouraged, and certain desires are suppressed. So it depends on where you are. So he uses this image of like a Nordic kind of Viking who had same-sex desire. If that person existed in the Viking times, his societal grid, his cultural grid, didn't show favor on that. So he just wouldn't have thought twice. Like, it wasn't an option to pursue that desire. Now, cutting people's heads off with an axe was in favor. Like, that was fine. So he acted on that desire, bloodlust, because it was culturally acceptable. Now, that same person with the same desires in 21st century America, the cultural grid here flips it. So that person might act out on those same-sex attraction desires, but not act out on the bloodthirstiness, because that's frowned upon. Mm-hmm. So all of that to say, the point of it is our desires aren't the defining feature. Our context and culture has more to do with it than who we are mm-hmm. in any sort of immutable personhood sense.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's good. And I like what you said about the need to celebrate and elevate singleness and celibacy. And we've got a great question along those lines, especially if we consider it in the context of church community. If we elevate the single calling, does that mean we as a church would promote single elders? This is a question for any of us, but Al, I'm going to give it to you.
Yeah, I've been on team with two single elders before, there's certainly no theological reason why we couldn't have single elders. There are plenty of experiential reasons personally, those two elders, it didn't go well, really didn't. And so for me, I've got experiential reservation. And I think partly it's the reality of what you're carrying from a shepherding load, and who do you share that with? And so one, theologically, we can't put it off the table, because what about Jesus? What about Paul? But experientially, we've got to be really wise. But it's especially, as you say, if someone is saying, man, I don't think I'll ever get married because I feel same sex attracted, and so I'm going to live celibate as a follower of Jesus, how could we not say, well, you could never be an elder? We could never say that.
Yeah, I'll just say we have considered this often when we do look at leadership in the church. And, you know, practically, as Al says, experientially, one of the things is that if character is such an important aspect of leading in the church and being an elder, as the Bible describes, oftentimes a man's character is not quite as refined until he's married. it does something. Yeah, thank you. Summer says you're welcome. It does something to act upon the growth and maturity of a man. Al, I see you grabbing for the mic. You want to say something on that?
Just to that, I you know, on the vodcast, we had Leah and Jacob Keith. Jacob Keith is a single man in Whittier. He's actually preaching there this week. And he kind of pushed back against that, saying, man, one of the things that I struggle, and he's basically said, I don't think I'll get married as I follow Jesus. Jesus might change my desire, but in his own words, I don't think I'll get married. So he is really counting the cost of what it might be long-term following Jesus in celibacy. And he said, you know, I often hear from the pulpit that marriage is the ultimate sanctifying crucible. and he's like, that may be, but then where does that leave me? Does that mean I can't get sanctified? And he said, and then he said this. He said, don't you think me going to bed alone every night when I'd actually like to have someone else in that bed with me, isn't that sanctifying? And I just thought it was profound. And I think we've got to be careful as married preachers when we talk about marriage as a sanctifying crucible, which it can be. But where does that leave singles?
And that's a conversation that is ongoing here. I mean, last week at the fast, our end of the fast speaker was Mike Pilavachi, who's a single celibate man who has been such a gift to this church. So this is by no means a rule, and I think there's an openness to that. Actually, just a quick one to you, Summer. Can parents opt their kids out of sex ed all the way through high school, only junior high?
There is a part of the framework that they need to be enrolled in the health class. It's a combination, at least I'm speaking from the Brea School District, is that the class is a combination of sex ed and also life skills. So there's a health and then there's a life skills component. I would recommend, as opposed to pulling completely out, which then you might have issues with, like, how many units they're earning towards graduation and things like that. Plus, you're going to be taking them out of curriculum that's going to be teaching them about compassion, tolerance, communication, all those kinds of things. I would say get in touch with your teacher. You know, just about every single teenager in Brea is at the Brea High School during the course of the day. So getting in touch with those teachers and just asking them, how are you going to approach this? Is there any material I need to know? And then opt out for portions of it. And also, if I can speak personally too, your child being enrolled in a classroom that delves specifically into these issues can be a catalyst for a very healthy conversation. And regardless of what you pull them out of, unless you pull them out of public ed, the issues that come up in those health classes, they are surrounded with every single hour that they're there. So you might be able to pull them out of the instruction and the discussion and the delving deeper into those subjects, but then you have to know they're going to get a surface level understanding from their peer group, and they're not going to get any instruction from the people that are actually trained to provide it.
Yeah.
And I would say that's a little dangerous. Mm. Teenagers aren't always 100% accurate.
And then they watch porn.
And then they, yeah, and then,
Then they watch porn.
So I would say, and I know it's tempting because it's easier, right? Like, okay, you're just not getting anything. Just come home, little lamb, and then I'll deal with you. But I would say, you know, they're supposed to be in the world. Not of it, but they're supposed to be in it. And that also means you've got to be in it with them and know what they're getting and look deeper into that stuff. And I would just ask. Sorry.
No, that's good. I mean, I...
Did I go too far?
I'm glad that these are anonymous because I can actually... I think, so I've been texted an image of where abortion does show up in the curriculum. And it's interesting because I think it raises...
Contraception or something?
I can't really read it. But I think the point of this image is, see, here it is. Abortion is mentioned in the curriculum. And I think you're saying, I don't think it isn't. And furthermore, if it isn't and it's not being talked about, then it's only being talked about in informal circles outside of some regimented curriculum. So just speak to that, because I'm interpreting a little bit, but I think it's kind of, there's a bit of outrage that abortion is discussed in public school curriculum. If I'm at all right about this.
Yeah, and it might just be a matter of semantics when you say, like, is it mentioned in a health class versus is there instruction?
Is it promoted and encouraged?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's different. So like, you know, in a health class, you might have information about what homosexuality is, but there's no instruction. There's no like lab portion of the how-tos. Do you know what I'm saying? And I'm not trying to make light of your question. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying like that might be raised, but it might not be from an instructional standpoint other than this is a thing.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
But there's no kind of bias. And the only, like I said, the only bias that the framework mandates is a bias towards abstinence for both STDs and
pregnancy.
As a contraception. Yeah.
Yeah. Al? Stop turning that microphone off. It's a switch.
It's a rogue microphone. Just going to ask you a question back about that, because, I mean, some of the outcry, and it is YouTube outcry, so I absolutely claim ignorance, you know, but seems to be like new categories being given in sex ed, even if it's not promoted, suddenly these are viable categories. And I really found what you said helpful in terms of public education is just a mirror of what is out there, trying to cope with what is out there, right, and help people to tolerate what is out there. But these newer categories, whether they're LGBTQ or categories of abortion, or even, as I understand, pederasty, suddenly dignifies the category. So to a young mind, it's like, oh, so that's that wasn't even an option. Now it's an option. So even if it's not being promoted, now this is a category that is being dignified, and now it's a possible choice. I think that's part of the outcry. Like, why do we have to have a category of pederasty? Just because it's out there, why should it be a category that's dignified?
Yeah, and to my knowledge, it's not. I think there was like an article that was put out with a YouTube video from somebody from BOA-USD saying, okay, yes, you know, it's being taught in regards to pedophilia. Pedophilia gets taught at Brea High School campus in the same way that, like, the Holocaust is taught. We define it. There is a historical precedent for it, but it's not something that's being advocated or endorsed. You know, we don't endorse genocide either, but we do teach it as far as this has existed. And I think that's a distinction that has to be made. In the same way that, you know, abortion is a real topic among teenage girls. It is. And so it's, if I can give any kind of reassurance, those topics do come up. But what is pressed most by the health teachers is abstinence. In regards to like pedophilia, that's usually not even something that comes up in the health classes. That's something that's taught with like your ancient history classes. if that makes sense. So it's not, by no means is it something that's endorsed or promoted. They're legally not allowed to promote anything, except they're required to promote abstinence.
Yeah. We actually are out of time, unfortunately. We left about a half hour for this. But this has been so good, I feel like we should do another one. But I wouldn't put that on you guys. Thank you so much for all of your hard work serving all of us. We really appreciate it. It's been very enlightening. We're going to linger for a little bit. These guys will be available if you want to speak to them and ask some further questions. I am sorry if we didn't get to your question. There were many, and I tried to spread it out among them. Feel free just to hang around for a little bit and do take a look at those resources. It's a Google Doc, and it's very helpful. So have a great night, you guys. Thanks for coming.